I'd like now to introduce Mark Cross. He's author of The Encyclopedia of Santa Fe and Northern New Mexico, and he will be at Opposite Books on Baca Street tonight at 6. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I love that you are not from here, and you wrote a book which is A to Z, encyclopedia of all kinds of things in Santa Fe and environment. You're from the East Coast.
Virginia.
You're from Virginia. Yeah. So how did you start to get into this, to make what resulted in the encyclopedia?
Oh, I think it was actually kind of a natural process. When I moved here, I was captivated, as many people who move here are. Most of us, I guess, because you have to kind of like it in order to work to stay here.
And it has to like you.
Yes, yeah. It took a while. But I started learning as much as I could because it's so different, you know, from what I was familiar with back east. And I just finished graduate school in history, so I was kind of in the mode to learn. And I came here, and the cast of characters was just entirely different, of course, and everything was different. And I was really interested. So I just learned everything. But I don't think that's unique. I think that happens to most folks who move here and decide to stay. I just started writing them down.
Yeah, although I have to say, there were so many things that people assume you know. When I first moved here, which was over 20 years ago, there were so many things that people referred to as if everybody knew them. And it would have been great to have a reference like this. But one is sometimes too embarrassed to ask. Like, yeah. Who's that? What are you talking about?
Right. Well, I was lucky. I got a job after I'd been here a year. I got a job at the New Mexico legislature as a proofreader. And so I worked with folks who came here as hippies in the 60s and people who grew up in Santa Fe from Hispanic families and folks from the Pueblos. So we would, it was very comfortable asking questions and making fun of each other, having people make fun of me, I guess, was more to the point.
Like the just off the bus
right
entry.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Oh, that's, I actually have a quick anecdote. I talked to an author I met at the dog park, somebody whose books I had read, a local person who'd been here forever, and I won't mention his name, but anyway, I had tried to find his birthday because I have years of birth for people in the book, and I didn't know how to do it, and I had a mutual friend ask him. So then when I introduced myself to him at the dog park, he said, "Oh, you're the one doing that, huh?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, when did you get here?" And I said, 1996. And he says, "Oh, you're just off the bus," you know. And I already knew what that meant. The origin actually is Debbie Jaramillo, when she wanted to appoint her brother-in-law as chief of police. This was after Donald Grady, I think, left. And then when Councillor Chris Moore objected, she referred to him as being just off the bus and therefore not in a position to comment on what she did.
You almost have to be from outside to write an encyclopedia of Santa Fe and Northern New Mexico like this, because if you're born and raised here, there are a lot of things that you take for granted that people who come in are really curious about.
Yeah, I agree. I think actually there's it helps to have that kind of newcomer's energy and curiosity, but you don't know enough. You know, I wouldn't have known enough in the first couple of years to do this, and so then I thought 10 or 15 years is about right. After you've been here long enough, it becomes part of the environment. You don't recognize it as being different, you know, or something that a newcomer wouldn't know.
We're talking to Mark Cross about the Encyclopedia of Santa Fe and Northern New Mexico. So there are a lot of things in it that anybody who's been here for a while knows, and even somebody who's been here for 15 minutes knows, like red or green, although they might not know that that's the official state question.
Right.
And there's a lot of official state things, the official state tie and things like that. Is there a place where the official state everything is recorded?
Oh, yeah. There's the Secretary of State's office puts out something called the Blue Book every 2 years. And that has all that kind of stuff. It's probably the closest thing, actually, to... It's not an encyclopedia because it's not alphabetical, but it's an interesting thing. All the state stuff's listed in there. Plus, working at the legislature, we got really tired of proofreading memorials and certificates. Let's make the official state this or that. So it's something that comes up every year. School kids always... Some teacher in elementary school suggests to her kids that they try to get something nominated, and so that's how that stuff happens.
Then there's quite a bit of not only Spanish words that are in common usage, but phrases that come from kind of the local Spanglish dialect. Like, we don't say crybaby here.
Right.
I found
right,
out.
Right. baby cry.
Baby cry.
Yeah, I learned this working just in the work environment. People would say, oh, he's such a lambe, you know, which means brown noser, I guess is a nice way to say it. Or hito, you know, which everybody knows. But my boss for a long time was a woman, and so there was a young man there that we called him the hito because he was so clearly the favorite, you know,
right,
in the office environment. So that's where I learned most of it. There are many, many more that I could have learned and put in. But
are there some that, I mean, there's definitely some humor in this book. What did you think were kind of the funniest entries that you put in the encyclopedia?
Oh, gee, that's a good question. I don't know. I was amused by a lot of it. You know, fact is always more amusing than fiction, or usually. Val Kilmer, I got a kick out of Val Kilmer. You know, people just kind of do things to themselves sometimes. And his comments.
What did he say?
Oh, you know, he's, among other things, he said that San Miguel County, he lives in, or he did live in San Miguel County, was the homicide capital of the world or something, and that 90% of the people in this county are drunk, or maybe it was 80%.
Yeah, 80%.
And then he thought about running for governor, and I just thought, geez, what are you thinking? You
know? Yeah, right.
So, and
you'll get 20% of the vote.
Yes, exactly, right.
Now, one of the entries is called the Mystery Sculptor.
Yes, yeah.
Who was that?
That's whoever carved out the word savage from the obelisk on the plaza. Most people know that it's been removed. I think it was in the 70s, and a guy with long hair, a young man with long hair, wearing work clothing, coveralls, I think, went and in the middle of the day, as I understand the story, and chiseled out the word savage because the obelisk is dedicated to soldiers who, I can't remember the exact quote, but among other opponents were savage Indians, and the word savage is politically incorrect, and so it was chiseled out. And one thing I didn't know is that the same word's been chiseled out from the Mormon Battalion Monument just south of Butterger's, because you don't hear that story often. But I went and looked at it and said, darn, it's gone. And people still argue, of course, about whether the obelisk should be there, and it's part of the local lore.
Now, there's a lot of people in the book, and I was thinking one of the tough things about doing a book like this is, I mean, there are so many people who are living here or who have lived here. Who makes the cut? Like, how did you decide which person gets in and doesn't?
I generally tried, as in all the entries, I tried to pick things that would tell a larger story. Wheelwright, Mary Cabot Wheelwright, I think, kind of, I think, is emblematic or personifies the feminine influence. I think that Santa Fe is a very feminine town and has benefited, I think, over the years from women who come from elsewhere to help in cultural pursuits or to help preserve the indigenous cultures or something. And Mary Cabot Wheelwright was somebody like that. There are many others, but I got her for sure. I probably missed some. I mean, there over the decades, you know, plenty of people who came here like that. Somebody else who really, oh, where did he go? Here we go. Eddie Gilbert. I think it's just a great example. Anglos generally come here to reinvent themselves, and he had made two fortunes, lost them, been convicted twice of felonies for financial misdeeds, served time in federal prison twice, came here and made his third fortune, and is a tremendous benefactor to the Lenzic and the Opera and all the nonprofits in Santa Fe. And I just thought, man, what a great opportunity. And a lot of people have done that. William Zeckendorf, I think, to some extent. Even as far back as Thomas B. Catron, who couldn't practice law in Missouri because he'd been in the Confederate Army, so he came here. It's always been this kind of refuge out of the mainstream place, I think, for people to start over. So,
why did you come here?
Kind of the same reason. No, I had...
the time in federal prison.
Yeah, right. No, in fact, I was kind of starting over. I went to... I didn't have a degree. I went to back to college in my mid-40s, and I was living in Northern Virginia and didn't have a job, and I had a friend who invited me to come here, and I visited and thought, well, I have to start somewhere, and I really liked it here, so I stayed, not knowing how hard it was to find, you know, a decent job.
Right.
So once I got the job at the legislature, I just figured, well, this is great. I'll stay.
So do you see the book as being more for newcomers or people who've been here a while or a little bit of everybody?
It's actually doing, I wouldn't, I didn't know, but it's not doing as well with tourists as it is with people who live here and who come here regularly. You
yeah.
know, there, I think there are a number of people who...
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I suppose. I asked at one outlet in town and was told, well, I don't know, they like picture books, you know. I think people who just come for a weekend or maybe 1 week and they don't come back don't want to by an encyclopedia.
Right, and they don't necessarily care about the subtleties of the colloquialisms or the cast of characters of the place. They're looking at nature and having a good time.
Yeah, or hanging out. You know, I mean, you can come to Santa Fe for a weekend and pretty much stay downtown, I suppose, and not get bored, I would think. But if you stay longer, then there's more to know, I would think.
I have to say, as I was looking through it, and I'm sure everybody does this, you think, oh, okay, did he think of this? And then you look it up, and it's always there. It's really
good.
Cool.
Thank you.
Even I thought, okay, did he put in E?
Yeah,
and you did.
Yeah, yeah.
Three E's. With an exclamation
mark. That's
how
I spell it. How I spell it. I don't know how other people spell it.
But many people don't know what the etymology is of E.
Yeah, right. Well, I kind of knew, but you have to nail things down. One that's particularly difficult is, I had an interesting conversation with Penn Lafarge, you know, and we've had some email back and forths about pronunciations, and they're just such a wide range of ways to say things. And he was offended that Hito is spelled H-I-T-O. In the book, and of course it's Ihito,
right?
It's the diminutive of son, which is spelled J-I-T-O, except everybody spells it H-I-T-O. In Spanish, an H is silent, so you would say Ito, but everybody says Hito, so
right. It's
one of those weird ones. And the more I looked into it, I just realized it's weird. It doesn't fit the rules, So people have a hard time.
But this is a Spanglish speaking culture and Spanglish spelling culture from time to time.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know. It's not possible to write. I'm not trying to write a Spanish dictionary anyway. I'm just trying to help gringos.
So what is the etymology of E?
Oh, it's from Ijole. I don't know. I say in the book it's Northern New Mexico's generic exclamation, sometimes translated as damn. Ijole is often shortened to E. And I don't know if that's a real etymology or not. But.
And one of the other things that I think is interesting that people don't always think of is that tamale is a Spanglish word. It's really an American word because the Spanish word is tamal.
Yes, yeah. I have my boss actually at the council service grew up in El Paso in a Spanish-speaking family. He's a fascinating guy. His brother was writer in residence at Stanford for a while. And so he always corrects me and tells me etymologies. But he speaks, his ancestry is Mexican, more than Northern New Mexican. So you kind of get some of that back and forth. But he was the one that told me that tamale always bothers him because it's tamale. It's like canal and canali. We all say canali, but it's the same. It's the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mark Cross is the author of the Encyclopedia of Santa Fe and Northern New Mexico, and he will be at Opsit Books tonight at 6 in the evening. Any other favorites that you want to leave us with before we go?
My favorite story, actually, which isn't well known to even to Santa Fans who've been here a while, is Dennis O'Leary's grave marker at Santa Fe National Cemetery. Do you have a minute?
I can tell you.
If you go to Santa Fe National Cemetery, you see 45,000 generic uniform grave markers, and you think they all look like that. But there's, in fact, this interesting one in, I think it was 1901, in Fort Wingate, which was near Gallup. It's a true story. This young soldier, I think he was 19, goes AWOL from the base. He's missing the fort. He's missing for like 2 weeks. Then he comes back, doesn't explain his absence. They lock him up in the stockade for a few days. He never explains what he's been doing. He comes out, and a few days later, he shoots himself. Commits suicide, and he leaves a note that says, "I would ask that the army send a some troopers in a wagon out to this particular spot to retrieve a memento of my death." So they follow his instructions. They take a wagon, and when they get there, they find a statue, essentially, of a tree trunk with a soldier leaning against it. He's got his cartridge belt, and on the tree trunk is inscribed Dennis O'Leary with his date of birth and his date of death, which he had anticipated when he was missing, when he was AWOL. And so he carved his own headstone, including the date that he knew he was going to shoot himself. So when they buried him at Fort Wingate, and they hauled the thing back and put it on his grave, then they moved all the headstones from Fort Wingate to the Santa Fe National Cemetery, where it is today, and you can go see it. It's really very cool.
Why did he shoot himself?
Oh, he was lonely and, like a lot of soldiers, I guess. Didn't have friends. I don't really know. That's the way in the story he's just described as being miserable in the army, and who knows.
Leave us on a happier note.
Let me think if I can think of one. Well, the population of Santa Fe has, in the 2000s, did not increase by 30 or 40% for the first time in decades. If that's a good thing, I don't know. It's a curious thing. I think it's very interesting. I have population figures in here and the rate of increase. I think it's under P for population.
Right.
I think that might be a good thing, just because if Santa Fe continued to grow exponentially as it had been,
it will ruin itself.
Well, yeah, you know, it wouldn't be the same place. Everybody says it's not the same place anyway, you know, depending on when you got here. But
right, in fact, there's an entry that speaks to that, Pinche.
Yeah, yeah, right, which means mean, spiteful, miserly. John Pendleton Fart says in turn left at the sleeping dog. He's actually very candid with his in his thoughts about what's going on in Santa Fe, and I think he's a credible source since his dad, of course, was Oliver LaFarge and, you know, been here forever, so...
And in your entry, it says that in that book, John Penn LaFarge says that Santa Fe has become pinche since its golden age between the 1930s and the 1950s. Most of us have never, we're not even born during that time yet, so
right.
We'll just take Santa Fe for what it is. And a wonderful book, The Encyclopedia of Santa Fe in Northern New Mexico. Mark Cross, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Vince Cadlebeck and Emily Montoya from Meow Wolf, who are part of the fabulous collective that's opening a new show this Friday from 5 to 9 in the evening. It's called Omega Mart. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you for having us.
So I went over to Omega Mart yesterday, even though it's not... Is it officially open yet?
Well, yes, it is open Wednesday through Sunday. We've been open this past week.
Okay. And so you've got people walking in to this... store, I'm doing finger quotes.
Supermarket.
It's a supermarket called Omega Mart, and in it you basically have yet another vehicle for the insane creativity of Meow Wolfers to basically do some of the things they want. It's all products in a kind of artistic supermarket.
Yes, Omega Mart specializes in nationally localized products and organically recommended produce.
And so some of those things include basically what look like at first glance. I mean, people are actually are walking in thinking it's a store.
Oh yeah,
they look. I mean, you've taken bottles out of recycling and painted them with.
Yeah, we recycled tons of old product. You know, that we had been using, just like trash bag fulls of stuff, and then created labels. A lot of labels designed based on kids' work that we did in elementary schools over the year, that Meow Wolf did over the year with kids here in town. And then we designed them, created labels, and a lot of stuff printed directly onto cardboard so that like it looks like real, legit products.
Yeah.
And it's located in a store that used to
be... Actual storefront, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be something. I don't remember what was there.
AAA.
Ah, it was AAA.
Yeah.
Okay. So in this store, you've got things like pork chaff. And elk dross and what was it? Porked beef or beefed pork?
Beefed pork, yes.
Yes. And all these things that you guys just came up with, which is, I guess, it's kind of an exercise in surrealistic imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the goal was to re-envision a grocery store and to basically get people who would never come to an art opening, but people who would go to the opening of a new grocery store in town, to get them totally convinced and to get them to come in thinking, oh yes, this is, I'm going to get great values here.
Now, you put a full-page ad in last week's Reporter.
Yeah,
and we've been doing ads for the past several months.
Yeah, we've been doing it. We did some trade with them. They gave us, you know, we've been doing a whole PR and marketing campaign since April that also involved, which was really great, like a level of this art project where, like, we had PR and marketing representatives meeting with, like, the New Mexican and Hutton Broadcasting and different media outlets in town. We had them meeting, in these fake PR and marketing meetings trying to, like, negotiate ad sales and stuff. But the Reporter actually gave us, like 6 or 7 full-page ads. So we've been promoting it this whole time for the last few months as, like, a legit supermarket.
Would anybody looking at the ads be able to tell that there's something fishy going on?
Maybe you would if you did look closely enough and you see we're selling stuff like type 2 diet beefies and honey clumps of and that kind of thing.
And things like, you know, the new Santa Fe store with Santa Fe in quotations for
brownies
and, you know, stuff
like
that.
And we also had this entire anti-Omega Mart campaign going on where we would run the Omega Mart ad that would say Alpha Products, Omega Savings. And then right next to it would be the protest Omega Mart in Santa Fe, like Alpha Problems, Omega Shamings, you know, so.
So basically, for anybody who was paying attention, there was this whole artwork going on the pages of the paper.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now you got young people involved from elementary schools.
Yes. Yes.
How did you approach them? What happened?
We had this program called Chimera, which basically we take Meowulf artists, instructors into the elementary schools. And the curriculum this year that we were doing for the second semester was Omega Mart. And so we basically presented the concept to them as like a joke, as like a practical joke on the entire city of Santa Fe, which got these kids, they're like third grade to seventh grade or eighth grade, got them like really jazzed right off the bat. Like they're going to play a practical joke on the entire city. And then
it wasn't a hard sell.
Right. No, it wasn't a hard sell at all. And then when we told them about like making fake products, it's like a kid's dream come true. Like, you know, putting them as the producer in the realm of consumerism, putting them on the producer side of it for once, you know, rather than being bombarded with, marketing, they could actually come up with it for once. So they loved it. They got way into it. And all of their products are on display there. As well.
Like sunscreen mayonnaise.
Yep. That's one.
What are some of the others?
Powdered dreams.
Yeah, powdered dreams.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
And there's some sculptural organs that can be used for organ transplants in the refrigerator section.
Yeah. Yes, far cheaper than the black market.
That's right. Now, what this, I mean, to me, when I look at this, it seems like a media literacy education campaign for these young people while they get to be funny.
Yeah, it was, and what's great about it, it's a media literacy campaign or media literacy curriculum without, you know, based directly like on in a hands-on way. We're not telling them what to learn. They're just learning about consumerism and capitalism and marketing and the media. They're just learning about it by doing the project directly. So it's not like we don't have any sort of like political, or we don't have any lesson that needs to be learned. Like, whatever lesson they learn is direct from the project itself. So,
and because, as you say, they've been bombarded with these messages since they were born, it's pretty well internalized.
Yeah.
They can start playing with it.
They're so ready to play with it, too. They get the joke right away. And
it's like whenever we ask them, okay, so what else is on the packaging? They would be like, oh, it needs to say fat-free. It needs to say
gluten-free,
healthy for your body, organic, or like they knew exactly the sort of like, you know, the buzzwords that would need to be on their products.
They got really into like the warnings to side effects.
Yeah, side effects like may include death. Like every product is that.
You may die.
And like gluten, what is it, gluten-free face cream or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh God, it's so much fun and hilarious. And like all Meowulf installations that I've seen, no matter how many times you go, you see new things because you can't take it all in at once.
Yeah, it's that maximalist mentality.
Right. How many people worked on it? I suppose you can't even count. Dozens.
Well, Meowulf people would probably be
30 or 40, 30
maybe.
Yeah,
maybe like 30 of us.
And it was a nice project. It was a nice project to open up to like a larger community too, because it's a pretty easy concept to just be like, just make products.
Right.
And then once you just give people that space, they could just, you know, start coming up with stuff. So people were dropping stuff off at the store, just sort of randomly.
People who weren't necessarily really part of the collective in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this opens on Friday. There's a big opening from 5 to 9 this Friday, the 20th of July, and you will be open for a while.
Yeah, we're going to be open Wednesday through Sunday, 12 to 8 p.m. Until September, like mid-September.
Now, are you actually going to sell anything that's in there?
Yes, all of our products are available.
We've actually done, it's been interesting to see. The people who know it's an art project are purchasing products. The people who are walking in thinking it's a grocery store are barely even capable of staying in the store for longer than like 5 minutes before feeling too awkward and needing to leave, as if like it's another universe that they were not supposed to be in.
Right. Is there anybody who walks in not knowing that it's an art project and then they just get it?
A few,
yeah,
right?
A few people will just walk around and get halfway through the store and then you'll just hear them say, oh, and then they start looking at it again.
And you stick around a little bit, yeah.
Well, it's hilariously funny, and the people who are clerks in the store, like you, Emily Montoya, are a little bit in character when you're showing people around. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Trying to make sure people are finding things okay and, you know, misting our fake produce
with
chemical
what?
Sprays and...
With
yeah, that's
with toxic pesticides, perhaps?
Yes, but only organically recommended toxic pesticides, of course. But like, that's one of the most fun parts of it, is working the store and seeing people's reactions.
Performative. Having the PA system, you know, to be able to do like cleanup on aisle two and do that whole deal.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's an addictive space, man. I've had a hard time leaving it when I'm there. Even if I'm not working, I'm just like hanging out because it's like, I think we succeeded at this one just as much as we did with the ship in creating an alternate universe that is fully immersive and sort of believable.
Right. So. And like, I think every installation I've ever been to, with the possible exception of the ship, but maybe not even that, it has that distinctive smell of paint and glue.
Yeah.
And Lord knows what else.
Yeah, exactly. We always end up, we're so good at going up to the last second. So the paint's usually, like, pretty fresh, you know?
Vince Kadlebeck and Emily Montoya are part of Meow Wolf and the Omega Mart, which is great because you have the O and the M as sort of, like, Greek letters, Omega Mart. But if you kind of take them off, it says Mega Art, which is intentional, I guess.
Yep.
Omega Mart, Mega Art opens this Friday, July 20th, from 5 to 9, but it's really open before that, so you can pop in the afternoons.
Yes, yeah. Come see us any day. We have excellent values, and we're waiting to serve you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Sure. I'd like now to welcome to the program Walter Hood, Jr. He's a renowned cultural landscape designer and professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And he will be here this Saturday, the 21st of June at 5 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium, doing a presentation called Ground Up, Culture and Landscape, sponsored by Creative Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk for a moment about culture and landscape, this whole idea of cultural landscape. What does that mean? What does that term mean?
What does cultural landscape mean?
Yeah.
It suggests that, you know, people live in a place, and over time they make the place based on their values and attitudes and beliefs about this world. So it's any machination or anything, right, that's created through that context of people with their environment.
The reason I ask is because when I think of landscape, I think of precisely that which is not cultural. You think of the hills outside of Santa Fe and the animals living there and the trees and the streams and so on. And within a city, somehow, I don't think of that as landscape anymore. Mm. And yet I guess in terms of when you're thinking about urban planning, it in a way it kind of is?
Yeah. I mean, well, landscape is all-encompassing. We just sort of create that dichotomy for ourselves that it's out there, not in here. You know, when you think of land and scape, it's pretty much what you see. So this idea that, you know, the world around us, the environment around us is composed of this landscape. And, you know, that dichotomy of what's out there, you mentioned the streams and the hills, you know, I would argue and particularly in the Southwest, that is a cultural landscape as well.
How's that?
Because people have inhabited that landscape for hundreds of years. It has not been, it's not as if the landscape has not been changed, altered, I won't say disturbed, but transformed because of the presence of people.
So when you go into cities and do projects and help cities to develop in a way that really takes culture into account and the way people congregate and the way people use cities, how do you understand a city, not only what you're seeing now, but its history? Take a place like Santa Fe.
Well, one of the things that, you know, I'm interested in and we do in my studio as well in my pedagogy and teaching is, you know, we have an information that we possess within our cultural setting that, you know, allows us to look back in time. And one of the things that we do, the first things we do is try to understand a place in time, because what we see today in many places is not what was there yesterday. But we also try to understand collectively, what is sort of the context of that the people bring collectively over time? Meaning if, you know, 20 people moves to the Southwest in 10 years, what do they create by being 10 people, but by also being in that particular landscape?
So when you have a place like Santa Fe, one of the cliches about Santa Fe that you hear people saying, I've heard it for all the 20 years that I've lived there, is the plaza used to be a real place. The plaza used to have shoe stores on it. The plaza used to be a place where people really hung out and where you could buy groceries and things like that. And now it's just a tourist area. And on the one hand, people would like it to be the way it was. And on the other hand, things evolve. What control does a community have over changes like that in a time, in a basically in a culture that is spurred by and controlled by business?
Right. Well, I mean, any place, you know, the plaza is an abstract idea, right? I mean, the plaza only gets its meaning based on use and belief, right? It's a constructed piece of landscape, right? So if, you know, if you arrived in Santa Fe and you had no understanding of Spanish history or even American history, let's say you came from a place that had, let's say, grounds, right, campgrounds or whatever, and you arrived in Santa Fe, you would not, if someone didn't tell you, you wouldn't think it was a plaza. It would just be this landscape. And so one of the things I think that you have to think of in places like Santa Fe is that the actions that take place around that landscape define the landscape. You know, this noted theorist, Jane Jacobs, you might have heard of her, wrote a lot about cities, but one of the things that I always I'm reminded by, she talks about parks as abstractions without the uses that act upon them. So in a way, the plaza, one can say the same thing. If there are still shoe shops, ice cream, soda parlors, you know, shopping and all that around the plaza, those uses are going to affect the plaza. If you have only tourist uses around the plaza, that's how the plaza gets defined. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's just the question, I think, is when a city like Santa Fe, or probably so many of the cities that you've worked in and that you've studied, grow very quickly and grow in ways that were not directed by the community, what is the community's voice in having that area the way it wants?
Well, the community's voice, I mean, I think is two ways. One is through advocacy, but in landscape, it's through use, right? I mean, again, the community can come out and use the plaza.
Right, and I would imagine, obviously won't do that if there's only stores where they can't afford to buy anything or don't want the things that are offered in those stores.
But you're associating then the use of the plaza through the stores. Maybe there is just a use of the plaza. Because if the land uses have changed, right? Again, as I'm saying, the land uses are dictating the space per se. But I think the community has the power to come in and use the space. They don't necessarily have to use the built space next to it if there is conflict. So someone could come out and have a picnic in the plaza if they chose that they want to be in the plaza. But that's a hard sell for a lot of people. They want that sort of connection.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, when you tell us maybe about some projects that you've done in cities where the community wants something different than what they've got. What is the process like for you at a cultural landscape guy working with residents of a city?
Well, our biggest, the biggest thing that I do in my work, I try to get people to see something that they haven't seen before. And I know it's probably at work in Santa Fe, like in most places. You're in a place most of the time, things start to disappear. And it's for us is to make you more acutely aware of your place, which might give you more opportunities, right? Opportunities to use something differently, opportunities, you know, to access something or make connections between things. But those opportunities, I believe, exist in every place. It's just that, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's covered up or we just can't see it because of, you know, just the kind of sociology that the spaces sort of create for us. Giving an example, you know, we worked on a project here in Oakland, California that was underneath a freeway. People always looked at it as a space next to a freeway. There were trees in the space. There were uses in the space that no one could see because it was fallow. We actually added a market and different uses to this space, and all of a sudden people could see the space differently. And they actually noticed that there were trees in the space, that they noticed all of these other things, that they were, it was always there. But they were only using the space in a very particular way. And so this goes
back
to...
And how did they start using it?
They started coming every Saturday for a market. And the market got bigger and bigger and bigger. And before you know it, now it's become the kind of the center to the community because the market gave it new meaning.
There are also interesting examples, I think, of we forget that our city has a particular terrain and there are reasons for that terrain. There's there's one, a city that you worked in where you began, along with the people who lived there, to realize that there were hills and that there had once been rivers.
Right. Well, the rivers are still there. There were creeks. I think you're referring to Pittsburgh. But, I mean, you know, when the water is all underground, people forget. But when there is an event, you know, that water finds its way to the surface. I mean, Santa Fe, you know, again, I've been there numerous times. You know, the city is located where it's located for a particular reason, right? But when I'm in the center of town, I don't see the water. I know where it is. The other interesting thing is, you know, the plaza that you see today or the Santa Fe you see today is not the Santa Fe of yesterday.
So how do you get people to sort of understand that? You're giving this presentation called Ground Up, Culture and Landscape. What's that about?
Well, it's really, again, getting people to understand how we invest in a place through being there. You know, not just economically, but how we are present in a place and how that can be a great investment. I mean, that's pretty much what I'm going to try to talk to people about and hopefully be some kind of jolt to people so that they can begin to transform the place in which they live and not have a fear, right, of losing something. And I think in places that have a very strong historic as well as a kind of a physical sort of situation like Santa Fe, and long, long history, cultural history, I think most of the time we're much more conservative as far as how we look upon those things. I think we're much too conservative, put it that way.
What do you mean?
Well, we choose to want to freeze things in time versus dealing with the idea of palimpsest. That, you know, places are made from layers and layers and layers, and none of those layers are superior to one another. They actually happen in a more creative way. They're built up over time. So when you go to great places in the world, you know, where different cultures have lived for long periods of time, we understand them through the palimpsest, not through a kind of a singularity of an idea about who lived here.
I think one of the problems we have in Santa Fe is that the river has virtually dried up, and there have been all sorts of initiatives to make the river alive again. But again, this is the kind of problem you get into when you have a huge influx of people and then
right.
the water gets allocated for uses other than actually running through the river. And restoring it is both a value that we hold and very hard to accomplish.
Yeah, but again, that's taking up position, right, that restoration is the way to go. And my critique would be you can't restore it because you've already moved in one direction. You know, and this is the problem, I think, in cities is that, you know, restorative ecology or thinking about restoration versus, again, if I'm thinking about building palimpsests, then I have to deal with the issue that, yes, there are more people here. There are people with different values and different attitudes about the place. But that can make a place just as marvelous as having the same people with the same ideas. I actually think they create a much more sustainable place, having that dialogue and being able to understand that people are different. And so that cities then become diverse, not just through the people, but how they're made. You know, I was just in Rome, and, you know, I was there for a week, and I go to this one restaurant, and it's in the Jewish ghetto, right? It's great that the Jewish ghetto is still in Rome. You know, in a lot of places, it would be gone.
Right, and Rome is such an example of a city where you can see in front of your eyes layers of history going back a couple of thousand years, and where the city really hasn't been afraid to change and transform itself.
Well, yeah, and again, you know, it's not that the city has not been afraid, right? It's just that it's one of those cities, right, that has just changed in these dynamic ways. The popes, right? I mean, it's people making change and us being able to sort of understand that. And I think in the democracy, right, in, you know, de Tocqueville talked about, you know, coming here when he was very young, writing about America. It's like Americans need 20 people in the room to decide on one thing. So, again, you know, how do we take, you know, this experiment, you know, which we're trying to develop, you know, where you have a diversity of people with different backgrounds coming to a place trying to make one thing. That's America. And so the one thing is constantly, you know, pushing back at the diverse thing. But to me, the one thing is the diverse thing, and we haven't figured that out quite yet. That it's not something that looks congruent and you can figure out. It is this kind of amazing, cacophonous, neighborhood-oriented, you know, diverse thing that we might call a New York, right? Or we might call a Chicago, or we might call a Los Angeles.
Walter Hood Jr. is a cultural landscape designer and professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And once again, he will be here this Saturday, the 21st of July at 5 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium, sponsored by Creative Santa Fe. He'll be talking about ground-up culture and landscape. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
I'm happy now to welcome back to the show Ben Swan. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and he joins us often to speak about animals. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me on board.
And Athene Westergaard is here. She's owner of the Caswick Gallery, which is on Water Street. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, you are having, there's an exhibit this weekend, part of which is notable because some of the proceeds are going to the animal shelter. What's
yes,
it all
they
about?
They are. Well, we are a relatively new gallery. We opened actually a year ago on Canyon Road and then moved at Christmas to go to Water Street. And everyone in the gallery is an animal lover, me especially, because my son and I just rescued a chicken when I was visiting him in China.
You rescued a chicken?
Rescued a chicken. We were in Guilin, and we were on the Lee River taking a cruise and got off, and we were going to the bus, and there was a chicken on the side of the road all trussed up, ready to be slaughtered, purchased and slaughtered. And the chicken, the hen, actually, had just given herself up, very, very limp. And we looked at it, and I thought, oh, my God, the poor thing, what a sad thing to see. We got into the bus, and we kept on looking behind us. And suddenly, my son jumped up, and he said, that's enough. I've had it. My son is a monk, and he doesn't believe in eating animals or killing animals. So he jumped out of the bus, and I turned around. I thought they had already slaughtered the chicken. But what had happened was the six-year-old son had started to play with the chicken. And he was throwing him up in the air and tossing him around and hitting him on trees.
Poor
and
guy.
Just abusing Aww. The chicken. So I turned and I watched my son. My son grabbed the chicken, and then he started to lecture the group. So this is an American, head shaved, in a monk's tunic.
Speaking
Chinese.
Chinese, okay.
Fluently. Talking to this crowd that had gathered around him. And basically telling them how cruel it was to the animals and how could they do this. And he asked them one very important question. If this was your mother, would you do this and eat her? And they answered, yes, we would. And then he must have asked them how much they would sell the animal for, because I saw him whip his money out of his pocket. He gave him 100 yuan, which is about $18. And he came back on the bus with the chicken. So we had a hen on the bus with us. I luckily had a piece of cloth that had just been hanging around, and for whatever reason I decided to take it, and I wrapped the hen in the cloth. And the other Chinese people on the bus said that they were very impressed with what he had done and that he had done the right thing. So we brought the chicken to the hotel, found a box to hide it in because we had to smuggle it in, found a grain store so we could get some grain. And the hen stayed with us for 2 days until he found a family that would take care of it.
That's
and
wonderful.
That was.
So,
and as a pet? Supposedly as a pet on a farm. So I said to Spencer, we can only take this so far, and you give it to someone, and then whatever happens. I hope the hen is happily laying eggs, but one never knows.
Direct interaction for animals.
And if they eat it, at least that they don't torture it first.
Well, I think it's a hen laying chicken, so that it's valuable for them for laying eggs. So hopefully it can live its life. Live its life and happiness in a Chinese farm.
So what are you showing at the gallery this weekend?
Well, we are showing a local artist, Alice Bailey. And she's, as they say, a Santa Fe favorite. She does a lot of jewelry with glass beads and semi-precious stones. I'm actually wearing one of her necklaces.
And she does dog necklaces?
She is doing a special, something special for this evening because part of the proceeds of the evening are going to the animal shelter. And she's going to be creating a special line of animal collars for cats and dogs and maybe ferrets, whatever.
Oh, okay. And they're for party animals.
Party animal collars, yeah.
They're very cute.
They're really unique.
And they are very cute and colorful. And they're going to have, I guess, a pun on celebrities. One is called the Lorraine Bacall. Lorraine Bacall. Instead of Lauren Bacall.
Right.
And then David Himes, who's a Maryland-based craftsman. He does custom woodworking. He has created some gorgeous tables. And he's come up and he's brought his new tables, his new line. And if anyone purchases anything, he is willing to transport them to their home for free.
So all of this is happening at the Caswick Gallery at 203 West Water Street here in Santa Fe, and some of the proceeds go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society.
Yes, and the opening reception is at 5 p.m. on Friday, and there'll be refreshments and also music by Caswick guitarist Hunter Beck and violoncellist Michael Cott. I guess they're local celebrities in some ways.
Well, excellent, and I want to thank you both very much for being here. Ben Swan of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and also the, it's not the Barkin Boutique, that's the one up in...
Look What the Cat Dragged In.
Look What the Cat Dragged In, which is the resale store right near the satellite clinic of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter right near Outback Steakhouse.
A very fun place to find anything you want. And now I've been putting really kind of clever little photos on our Facebook page so people can try to figure out what they are because we get such unique things and some things are very confusing. So it's a little game that I'm playing that you get a little bit discount when you go in. See you
there. Excellent. Good. Well, thanks both for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.